Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to Donna Padacci of the Spanish Colonial Art Society about the exhibition Threads of Devotion, The Wardrobe of La Conquistadora. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Courtney White. He's co-founder and executive director of the Quivira Coalition, and the coalition is having its 9th annual conference this coming November 10th through 12th in Albuquerque. It's called The Carbon Ranch, Using Food and Stewardship to Build Soil and Fight Climate Change. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
As usual, you are doing work that is presenting me and presumably everybody else with things that I had no idea about. And one of these things that you are working with and that you'll be talking about in great detail during this upcoming conference is that in addition to the air and forests and the oceans, the soils of planet Earth are a tremendous carbon sink. They
Right.
sequester carbon.
Right. And it was news to me, too. I mean, I'd kind of known through our work, working with ranchers, working with farmers, that carbon dioxide through photosynthesis could get stored in soils. And I thought it was sort of interesting. And I kind of never made the connection until I started digging into this a little bit. And I realized just what a phenomenal sink soil can actually be. It can hold, I think they've estimated, up to 3 times what the atmosphere can hold. And why this becomes important for anybody out there concerned about climate change is that we're over the threshold. And most scientists think that we need to be at 350 parts per million carbon dioxide content. We're at 390. If we stop burning coal tomorrow and stopped all the emissions that we're talking about, we're still over that limit. We're still 40 parts per million over that limit. The question becomes, how do you pull it down? Well, there's only one way to pull it down. You've got to put carbon dioxide into sinks. There's only 4 sinks. The atmosphere, which is saturated. The ocean, which is getting saturated.
The ocean really is getting saturated. I mean, it's getting acidified. You've got the coral reefs dying. You've got
right.
a lot of problems.
We don't want it to be saturated. And then you have plants, trees in particular. There's been a lot of talk about the role of forests in absorbing carbon dioxide.
And again, those are in trouble.
Those are in trouble. And the problem with vegetation, of course, is that you can cut trees down. They can burn up. They die. They decompose. So you can't really store carbon for long periods of time in vegetation. It does a great job of pulling it out of the atmosphere. But does it do it for a long time? No, it doesn't. But you come to soil through the plants, through absorbing carbon dioxide through the plant process, into the roots, into the soil, stays there. And it can stay there for a long, long time.
What does that actually look like? How is it stored? I always thought that through photosynthesis, okay, you absorb carbon dioxide, but then the plant gets eaten, and then the cycle.
That's a good question. The ecologists that I've read, folks who are going to talk at the conference, talk about sort of the biochemical process of carbon dioxide gets turned into sugars, and the sugars then are absorbed and become part of the plant, and then they go out through the roots into the soil. Part of it just becomes food for the plant, and it sits there in the soil and is stored if it's not used. It's a whole kind of chemical process. It's called exudation. Don't ask me the details about the chemical process. But
meanwhile, it is, according to the science that you are talking about, that will be probably detailed in some detail in this conference, a real, genuine, long-term carbon sink.
Right, right. That's why folks are excited about this. There's two things that to keep in mind when we talk about working on climate change and the soil connection. One involves plants, and plants are good things. We like plants. We want to grow more plants. We want to grow more grass and put more carbon dioxide in the soil. And also the quantity of grasslands around the planet is huge. I mean, 2/3 of terrestrial Earth, you know, non-ocean Earth, is grasslands. And I don't know what the acreage is, but it's some large amount. And if you could affect improvement, carbon storage in those grasslands through stewardship, through whatever it takes, you could actually pull many, many parts per million carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And one scientist, Dr. James Hansen, who's kind of the chief climatologist in the country and works for NASA, has estimated you could pull as much as 50 parts per million out of the atmosphere, put it in soils. That would get us back to 350. And I think probably a lot of your listeners know the magic 350 number now. We just had a big celebration of it on Sunday. Bill McKibben, other folks, it's sort of the target now. We try to get that number down to 350. Well, soils is the way to do it, theoretically. There's a lot of challenges, and we're going to talk about those challenges at the conference as well.
So this affects, in large part, people who are engaged in ranching. Mm-hmm. And, okay, because there are grasslands, and whether they're public land or private land, you've got cows munching on the grasslands. You've got all kinds of situations, including overgrazing and so on. The methods of ranching that you're talking about not only produce higher cattle yields, but they produce higher yields of grass and native grasses of all kinds, biodiversity, wildlife. I mean, it's basically using ranching as a way to foster both carbon dioxide reduction and biodiverse land.
Right, right. It's kind of a complicated process, kind of a complicated thing to think about. Let me tell you a little story. We've been working with ranchers, progressive ranchers, for many years here, working on land stewardship questions, even local food, how to produce food locally, how to move animals around, you know, the hoof impact on the lands, kind of stirring things up, growing more grass where there wasn't any before. A year ago, in August, I was sent a publication by World Watch Institute, which is an environmental group, and it was called Mitigating Climate Change Through Food and Land Use. And it was sort of a loud bell for me, it went off, was that the lower half of that title we'd been working on with many folks for the years, which is the food and land use part of it. You know, we can produce local food, we can improve land health through animals, grazing, things like that. I'd never thought about the climate connection at all. And so I opened it up, I went down the list that they recommended: climate-friendly livestock practices, building soil carbon, local food production, restoring degraded watersheds. These are things that Kavira has been doing for years. And not just Kavira, other organizations, other nonprofits, ranchers have all been kind of working on this, but no one had thought about the climate connection before. But wow, we're doing all of this. Why not then think about how to link it from food and stewardship and growing grass to carbon in the air in the form of carbon dioxide, pull it down. And that's why I made up the term the carbon ranch. Let's think about how we can ranch carbon. Now, carbon is essential to life, as everybody knows. It's only bad when it's in excess, like in the atmosphere or in the oceans. Food is carbon. Animals are carbon. We're carbon. It's an interesting idea to think about how to kind of ranch for it. So not just for pulling carbon out of the sky, putting it in the soils, but to think about local food production, think about animals, think about grass, think about growing more grass. A rancher who's going to be speaking at the conference, John Wick, who runs a project in California called Marin Carbon Project, where they're expressly trying to quantify the carbon they're putting in the soil, says there's no downside to this. It's got all these great positives. You have food, animals, water. I mean, it's really kind of an interesting way of looking at these lands.
What are some of the ways in which it actually works in terms of different methods of moving cattle herds, for example?
Okay. Well, we were looking at a property outside Santa Fe for maybe a demonstration project, and we kind of looked at it carefully, and I can talk about some of the challenges that we found out there. But on the positive side, it was a ranch that had been overgrazed. Then it had been rested, and it was owned by a nonprofit here in town. And they asked us to kind of look at the possibility of ranching it for carbon. And the quick answer to your question is that a lot of the ranch had bare soil, just a kind of a function of the way it was. It didn't have enough grass in the right places. So the way to immediately sequester more carbon on that particular piece of land was to grow more grass. Now you can do that in different ways. You can drill it. You can hand seed it. But you can also run cows across it and stir it up. And it's called targeted grazing. You can target the animals in certain areas You don't have to seed it. A lot of that seed's in the ground. You can manage the animals, and then you can grow more grass. This is maybe news to folks still. For many of the ranching community, this is not news. It's been a way they've kind of looked at landscapes, rehabilitated damaged land through livestock, carefully controlled, carefully timed. You graze them, you pull them off. So we are looking at this particular piece of property as a way of kind of using animals as a tool to rejuvenate it, to grow more grass where there had been bare soil before. And by that simple fact, we would be sequestering more carbon than the ranch was doing previously. It was an interesting idea. Now there are a lot of challenges on the economic side of it, and this is where it gets complicated.
But how is it that running cattle across the land will cause grass to grow?
Well, it has to do with the sort of the interaction of animals and disturbance on these landscapes, meaning the animals kind of run across, and they, if you looked at soil that hasn't been disturbed by any animal, wild or domestic, for a while, in New Mexico, you'll see that it's got a hard cap to it. I would ask folks to sometime, if you're hiking around, looking around a landscape, bend down, look at something that's not got grass on it. You'll see that it's got a hard top to it. That's what happens when rain hits it. Rain splashes dirt up, comes down, it seals it, got a hard cap to it. That keeps grass seeds from getting into the soil. It's anybody who's a gardener knows what it says on the back of those packages, press seed firmly into soil. If you're a grass plant and you're shattering your seeds at the end of the season and they're falling on dirt that's hard capped, they're just going to blow away or wash away. And nature had a way of disturbing these landscapes. And this has kind of been a big change in the science community, looking at the role of disturbance. Fire, for example, is a form of disturbance. It's been negative. We thought of it as a negative disturbance. Now we think of it as a positive disturbance, if done right. So we have a lot of prescribed fires now that we didn't do before. Grazing is in the same place. It can be a positive force for disturbance or a negative if it's, you know, done too hard, done too long. But these animals can walk across this landscape. Goats do it. Sheep do it. Cows do it. And cows are good because they're heavy and they have big feet, and they can break up that cap, and those seeds get back into the ground. That's why it's called targeted grazing. You can target the animals right on a certain spot, and they can get an ecological effect out of it, whether it's for carbon purposes or beating back noxious weeds or, I mean, any number of things.
We're talking to Courtney White of the Kivira Coalition. When you run cattle across a piece of land, I mean, part of the vision of the ranch, this new kind of ranch that you're talking about, involves not only using them to disturb the soil so that more grasses will grow, but also keeping them in groups where they're pretty close together, eating one section of land and then moving them so they can eat another section of land and the first section can regrow.
Right. It's a herd effect. And what the ranchers who employ this kind of technique are doing is emulating herding animals. Animals, you know, like bison, for example, who herd up and they move. They never stay very long in one place and they move on. This is a similar effect. So they're there, they've eaten, they've disturbed the soils, they've fertilized it, and they have moved on. And that's kind of nature's model of herbivory around the planet. Whether it's wildebeest in Africa, if it's elephants, if it's cattle here in the Southwest, sheep.
Buffalo.
It's the same kind of pattern. It's when cattle are not allowed to act as a herd, when they tend to be, when they loaf or they linger or they're too long in one place, they're not as a group, then we tend to get the kind of environmental damage that most folks associate with overgrazing. So it's a matter of kind of herding them up and moving them out, and there's different ways, different techniques of doing that. And if you make the climate connection, if you can say that this has a climate effect, meaning that we are delivering, in a sense, an ecological service to people who live in cities who care about this, then we make a very interesting link between urban and rural. So we want folks who live in cities are worried about it. Folks in the rural communities have a way of delivering this service through their management techniques. How do we make that connection between urban and rural and make it work?
Again, another part of this is that if you are simulating the herd
behavior of the ancestors of our current domesticated livestock, you move them around in herds instead of letting them graze individually on huge tracts of land. You also actually save a lot of time because you don't have people out rounding up cattle that takes a really long time.
That's right.
They can move them in a day.
That's right. And the animals get trained up to this. I mean, they expect it. I've been on many ranches that practice this, where the animals can see the ranch owner or the ranch manager coming, and they get excited, and they move to the gate, or they move to the electric fence, whatever is going to be opened, and they open it, and they move through to the new pasture. They close it behind them, and off they go. So they, you know, they become habituated to this kind of management style. They knew that fresh grass is on the other side, and it's not a labor intensive practice. It's more of a paradigm intensive kind of way of looking at landscapes and how to manage them. Now, in the past, what's interesting is that most ranchers who do this were looking at productivity, how to grow more grass, how to have bigger herds, how to therefore make more money to stay in business. Along comes the local food movement that says we want grass-fed food, we want it from a nearby ranch. So that community starts feeding local communities from these operations. And now we add the climate part on top of it. So it becomes a pretty interesting equation of stewardship, which is really soil building. That's why you call it a conference on soil building, because that's what they're doing. They're trying to build up soils through grasses. And then we produce a local food product to a local community. And at the same time, you're sequestering more carbon dioxide in the soils. How cool is that?
Well, it seems like, as you said, an all-win, no-lose proposition. Why isn't everybody jumping on it immediately?
Well, a couple things. One, it's new. I've been in this business for a while. I hadn't thought about this connection until last year. Number two, the economics are difficult. I mean, how does a rancher get paid or compensated for pooling carbon dioxide out of the sky and putting it in the soils? Well, right now, that mechanism doesn't really exist. There's been a lot of talk over the last year about cap and trade, for example. If there was a cap on carbon, could ranchers get paid for sequestering that traded carbon in their soils? That market's collapsed. There's not going to be a cap and trade bill ever, I think, between you and me.
And our gazillion listeners.
And our gazillion listeners. I have mixed feelings about the cap and trade, to be honest with you. And this is a whole kind of other discussion about offsets and kind of how the marketplace can handle these things. We'd rather see the carbon part of this as an added value to the beef. So if you buy a hamburger from a climate-friendly ranch, you might pay a little bit more, but you know that this ranch is trying to contribute to the solution of climate change. So it's an idea that ecologically is not terribly complicated. There's an issue about monitoring and measuring and quantifying the amount of carbon that goes into soils. There's sort of dueling monitoring protocols. I won't go into all of that, but it's sort of a funny way of going about it. What's difficult is, two things that are difficult: making the economics work so that the ranchers get paid. And that's, again, trying to find the link from the urban-based consumer to the rural-based producer. How do they make an economic link between each other so that they're helping each other? And the other thing is just the kind of phenomenal disinformation campaign about climate change in general. And
yeah.
And if you're a skeptic, just kind of off the bat, this is going to be a hard sell for folks, particularly in rural communities, that you're going to say, well, that's a city thing. We're not interested in that stuff. So it's got kind of those challenges right in front of it. No easy answers to any of those.
Well, what about the idea that having a carbon ranch and having a ranch where the soil is not degraded ultimately saves ranchers money?
It does. And again, as I said before, it also helps them raise stocking rates. More productivity on the ground, there's more grass, they should be able to run more animals. Is that enough economically to stay in business? I don't know. It's tough. I mean, it's tough out there for many ranchers, when diesel prices go up and they're rising again, this all becomes kind of a real challenge. I wish we could find a way, I don't know how to do this, that we could really sort of pay rural producers to do this. You know, I mean, as a nation, we pay other parts of society to do things. If we could figure out a way to kind of,
you mean like oil subsidies and things like that?
Oil subsidies. Well, you know, for example, the government right now, it was interesting. I heard a story on NPR that they're paying to put broadband into rural communities. I mean, to bring the internet to remote rural towns. The private industry won't touch it. It's just not profitable. It just they won't do it. So the government's stepped in and said, look, we'll put up the money. It's kind of an analogous situation, I think. You know, think of the internet when it got started. It was a project that the government really supported initially, and then it took, you know, obviously became its own thing. Something like that, where we can have some kind of investment up front, whether it's government money or somebody else's money, to kind of get early adopters to start thinking about this. What's neat about this idea is, while we wait for Congress to act, while we wait for the international community to act, to make a decision about legislation or caps or whatever, or we wait for the engineering community to come up with a solution, here's a technology that we have on hand right now.
It's called low technology.
It's low technology. Everybody, we have a culture that is fixated on high technology. You know, we're going to high-tech this, we're going to high-tech that. We're going to capture carbon dioxide coming out of these coal plants, and we're going to stuff it into the ground in some cave. Well, that technology is not here.
Yeah.
No, and I read a story the other day in the paper about fusion, nuclear fusion. They're trying to figure out how to get a nuclear fusion thing going. Well, while we all wait for that, tapping our toes, here is a technology, a low technology, that's available right now. It involves grass, photosynthesis, animals, water, people, food. I mean, again,
why is it expensive for people to do? What is the actual cost of changing from the current style ranch where there's a huge open range to a smaller range, moving them from place to place? Is it just building fences?
Well, there's not a huge cost involved. I mean, electric fencing is not that expensive.
Does it have to be electric?
No, barbed wire is much more expensive, however. I mean, to string a 5-strand barbed wire fence a mile, it's like $1,200 or something like that. I mean, it's really a lot of money. And that's a permanent fence. Most ranchers like to use temporary fences, electric strands. That's not that expensive. The other costs are not that high. The problem becomes finding markets, like grass-fed beef markets. I mean, there are some built. If you want to be organic, there's a cost of, you know, doing all the paperwork, going organic. It is a higher cost product, but it's missing the subsidies that most of industrial agriculture enjoys. And so, the way that corn is subsidized, the way that fossil fuels kind of subsidize a lot of this. So if you're working outside that whole system, you don't have that backup to help you kind of meet some of those costs.
But I mean, okay, in New Mexico, we've got lots of ranches. Are they working currently outside the subsidized industrial agricultural model?
Well, not most of them. I mean, if most folks are still in sort of the commodity beef production model, and that, you know, that serves them well. I mean, it's a system that's been around for a long time, and it's helped a lot of family ranchers stay in business. And the feedlots, kind of the industrial food beef system. And some of those ranchers are very good stewards to take very good care of their land. I mean, so it's...
But their cattle are eating corn.
Their cattle are eating corn. And the question then becomes, are you part of...
Which isn't very good for cattle.
It's not good for cows. You know, there's questions about what the greenhouse gas emissions are from the industrial food system. So that's been the subject of some debate lately. The position that we take is that a grass-fed operation, which is, you know, a ranch that you know, has their cattle on grass from birth to death, and a local food system reduces emissions. So a carbon ranch does a couple things. It sequesters carbon in the soils through stewardship, but also tries to reduce emissions. So it tries to confront the role the ranch plays in actually producing greenhouse gases and tries to pull it down. And that's also a challenge. I mean, if you have a big ranch and a truck that you have to drive around to get around the ranch, I mean, you're producing greenhouse gas emissions. This is not a simple project. I mean, it's something that involves stewardship and emissions and kind of the co-benefits of food and other things, water, figure out how to get paid for it, kind of think about all these things on top of, say, drought, on top of, you know, just the usual day-to-day chores of running a ranch. It is sort of complicated and daunting, and yet I think it's a tremendous opportunity at the same time. I feel pretty strongly, and we're going to talk about this at the conference, that there is a opening here, a burgeoning opportunity for landowners in New Mexico to take advantage of this climate crisis. So again, if society thinks this is a problem, here is a potential solution or part of the solution. We should figure out how to link the two parts together. And
this is something that could be done also on a state level.
Sure. Sure. And frankly, it can be done by anybody. I mean, the whole idea of just sort of growing more grass where you live, and in our little house, a little plot of land we have, just we look at where the bare soil is and think, well, how can we increase the carbon soil content of the soil here? Now, you know, are we affecting climate change globally? No, of course not. But I feel like you're doing something at least. Statewide, nationwide, I mean, there's lots of things that potentially can be done. Is it going to solve the climate problem? No, but it can be part of the solution. Again, we have to pull it down. At the same time, we have to address the emissions issue, which is coal and fossil fuel. And the climate problem won't go away until we do. In the meantime, here's something that can be done on the ground right now.
We're talking to Courtney White of the Kivira Coalition. And the conference that's coming up, the 9th annual conference of the coalition, is November 10th through 12th in Albuquerque. It's called The Carbon Ranch, Using Food and Stewardship to Build Soil and Fight Climate Change. And you will be receiving an award, the Michael S. Currier Environmental Service Award, administered by the New Mexico Community Foundation. And that is a great honor this year.
It is an honor, and it was a surprise, and I am touched and humbled by it.
Who should come to this conference?
Well, that's a good question. Like most Kivira conferences, I think a cross-section of folks should be interested, meaning landowners who are looking at sort of different ways of earning money, staying in business, stewarding their lands. We have a lot of agency folks come because they are in charge of landscapes and they have to think about these things. Scientists come, tribal folks come, but also a lot of folks who consider themselves conservationists, folks who live in cities, folks who are concerned about issues like where the food comes from, what it's made of, and now folks who are concerned about climate. So I think anybody who's got kind of a concern, you know, somewhere all of the above or one of the above, this ought to be a event for you. It's a, we kind of specialize in, how do I put this, upbeat. I mean, we're trying, not unrealistic kinds of hopeful sorts of things. It's all pretty pragmatic, but there are answers to these problems. And so we try to find them, talk about them, have presenters come, talk about their experiences, and folks come away from the conference understanding that there are hopeful things out there. And this year we got folks coming from different points of the planet.
Yeah, you've got somebody from Kenya.
Kenya, Australia. Constance Neely is coming. She's working in Kenya right now. It's interesting. The rest of the world is sort of on this. Australia in particular, they've been working on soil and carbon questions for a while. The United Nations FAO has been publishing publications on these kinds of things. It's just now kind of getting into the western part of the United States. We start sort of thinking about climate and food and water and land. So we're having folks come in, kind of talk about their experiences, why this is not just a wild and crazy idea that actually has pragmatic possibilities and kind of a different way of looking at stewardship, food, and climate all at the same time.
I'm reminded of the conversation we had recently about prairie dogs and how prairie dogs co-evolved on the prairies and actually were integral to the health of the grasslands along with the bison and other large mammals on the prairies. And what we're moving toward, I think, and there's if people come to the conference or they look at their website, there's a kind of map with cities, suburbs, agricultural land, cattle land, fallow land, and all of these things coexisting. But we're moving, I think, in terms of paradigm shift into a model of cohabitation, coexistence, and above all, interdependence.
Right. Well, this is the, I wouldn't call it silver lining, because there is no silver lining to the climate problem, is that it kind of, we're all in the same boat here. I mean, whether you're a prairie dog or a pika or a polar bear or a human or a child, we're all facing the same challenge, which is, you know, what's going to happen down the road if we don't do something. And so the idea of having to figure out how to coexist, how to get along, how to learn from each other, share this landscape, share the strengths of each part of this landscape, and every one of them has a way it fits together. So prairie dogs have their role, cattle have their role, bird watchers have their role, food eaters, food producers, wind farms, solar panels. I mean, so they're all kind of part of the same landscape. When you look at it, how can we live here and do these things? How do we sequester more carbon in soils? How do we reduce emissions? How do we achieve sustainability? That's not a word I like very much. And the only way to do that is to not balkanize and separate us into little pockets and generally pity one against another, but try to figure out how we integrate these things. And that's why we made a map where we kind of put all these ideas on one landscape as a kind of a roadmap, if you will, to how I think these things should go. And the map doesn't have any public lands versus private lands. It doesn't have any kind of us and theming in it, which unfortunately is a big part of our culture these days.
Unfortunately, it's really too bad.
Well, it's getting worse, I think. And I am fearful about what's kind of down the road in terms of partisanship, not just D.C. and politics, but we seem to be drifting more towards finger pointing and less towards problem solving collaboratively.
Yeah, and if I may say so, it has more to do with really consciously orchestrated propaganda campaigns working through the media than it does people really having genuine enmities with each other personally.
Right.
I don't have any enmities with anybody in New Mexico, and you don't either. We are trying to bring people together,
right.
and so are we all.
Right, and that's and it's a challenge. I don't have any, fortunately, bright ideas about some of that. I can tell you from my own experience, Alder Leopold, the great conservationist, once said that the only real progress that matters is that which happens on the back 40, and that's been exactly my experience. On the back 40, there's a lot of neat stuff going on.
Now, just for what do you mean by the back? What is meant by the back 40?
Back 40 acres.
Right.
Homesteads generally were 160 or 320 acres. So there's always a back 40, meaning that that's where the woodlot was, or that's where the cows went and hung out. It was just the back 40. The front 40 is where. So the front 40. Let's talk about the front 40 in America. Is where all that stuff is that you're talking about. The media, the politics, everything's on the front 40. On the back 40, there's cool stuff going on. Cooperation, innovation, ideas like how to sequester carbon in soils, grass-fed food production.
Coalition building, new friendships.
The larger word I use is kind of an agrarianism. There's kind of an agrarian thing that's starting. It's for a lot of reasons. A lot of youth today in particular are interested in food production, where the food comes from, kind of a back-to-land thing. And it's kind of wrapped up in this idea that we're part of the land and we all have to be healthy at the same time. So there's kind of an agrarian thing that's happening on the back 40. It's very exciting. You don't hear much about it. folks who come to our conference are part of the Back 40 largely, or they are speaking at the conference themselves. And that's where I find my hope, is in those landscapes. You never hear about it on the Front 40. I've actually trying to not expose myself to the headlines of the Front 40 these days, because, oh, man, it's just so awful. So we spend our time kind of working on the Back 40. So,
well, it's awful, and it's a lot of it is fabricated.
Right.
In terms of...
Very intentional.
Yeah.
And we start thinking about the forces behind those intentions, the powerful forces behind those intentions.
It's basically a small number of industry groups.
Yeah, it gets kind of depressing. You think about it. It's like, what do you do about that kind of... I know. So we ask ourselves, what do we do? What can we do? So I would encourage your listeners, if you're so inclined, interested in the Back 40, to come to the conference, because you'll find a whole lot of folks of a like mind. And we draw about 500 people. It's an unusual mix of ranchers and conservationists and other folks, all kind of working on the Back 40, kind of working towards similar goals. And now we're trying to put the climate question on top of things we've all been working on for a while. And it's actually pretty exciting.
Just a few titles of events that are going on during this conference. Here's one. Bringing life back to your land, moisture, microbes, and climate change. And here's another one. Mob grazing workshop by Greg Judy, who's a rancher and mob grazing educator. We have one called Mitigating Climate Change Through Food and Land Use, and so on. I mean, things that are all the kinds of things we're talking about. Soil building through microbial pathways, mechanisms for soil carbon sequestration, healing the world with holistic high-density grazing. It just goes on and on. And it's so exciting. And, I mean, just for me preparing to have this conversation with you today, I didn't know about any of this stuff, except for the some of the stuff that was in your last book, Revolution on the Range. And when we talked about that, that itself was a regulation. But the carbon part of it, it also, I must say, lends some hope for us meat eaters.
Right, right. There's a story I brought with me here, Time Magazine did last January. And it's interesting because the title of it, here, I'll pull it out. It was interesting to, it's called Save the Planet, Eat More Beef. And the idea was, because you hear this pretty consistently when you go to conferences, people ask, what can I do? What is it I can do to address the climate problem? And generally, the response is eat less beef, meaning, and what they're saying is that you try to get off the industrial food system that consumes a lot of fossil fuels. What they neglect to tell you is that the ranchers who are doing grass-fed local food production are actually part of the solution, not part of the problem. And so as a meat eater, I would say if you are going to eat meat, eat from a carbon ranch, if
eat
you can
from
find
a carbon
one.
Ranch. Grass-fed.
Grass-fed, local, ranches that have... rotational grazing, things like that. Now it's challenged a little bit to find some of those folks. There's some organizations in town that can help. A lot of folks will be at the conference, those kind of things. I want to put a quick plug in for our opening night speaker, who's written a lovely book on the history of dirt. And you think, why would somebody write a history of dirt? I mean, how could, it's dirt. His point is that we treat dirt like dirt, and dirt actually is extraordinarily important.
It is that from which all of our food comes.
Everything springs from dirt, and if you don't take care of your dirt, if you erode it, if you wash it away or let it blow away, you end up having serious trouble. And, of course, he goes through the Romans and the Greeks and other folks who have had trouble holding on to their dirt. Then he brings us up to date with our current trouble holding on to dirt. We're not doing a fabulous job. And yet, at the same time, there are practices that build soil, that keep dirt in place. It doesn't have just to be cows. There's other things that folks can do to kind of restore, rebuild dirt. So his name is David Montgomery. His book is called Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. He's a very dynamic speaker. It's a free public event Wednesday night at the conference. We're at the Embassy Suites down in Albuquerque. So David's going to give an opening talk on why we should all be thinking about dirt. And then we opened the conference the next day talking about DIRT's possibilities for climate and food and water and all that kind of fun stuff.
And by the way, if people want to register for this conference, first of all, early registration ends tomorrow. You can register up to the day of the conference, but there's a special deal for early registration that ends tomorrow, the 21st of October. What is the number that people can call to find out more information?
The Kavira number is 820-2544, 820-2544.
In the area code 505.
505. We're here in Santa Fe, and also it's very easy to register online. It's all set up. Folks can go there and register for the conference.
At KiviraCoalition.org. Courtney White is co-founder and executive director of the Kivira Coalition. The ninth annual conference is November 10th through 12th in Albuquerque. For more information, you can go to kiviracoalition.org, and that is spelled Q-U-I-V-I-R-A, coalition.org. I'll also make a link to it on my website. Courtney, thank you so much for being with us once again on the Radio Cafe.
I appreciate it.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome Donna Padacci. She is the executive director of the Spanish Colonial Arts Society and is here to talk about the exhibition Threads of Devotion, The Wardrobe of La Conquistadora, which is running for the rest of the year at the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, tell us about La Conquistadora. Who, you want to call it a she. It's far more than an inanimate object at this point.
Well, the very devout call her Our Lady. La Conquistadora is a religious icon that was brought up from Mexico in 1626 by a priest. She resides at the cathedral, Basilica, here in Santa Fe, and she is the only religious icon in the United States that has ever been crowned by an ambassador sent by the Pope.
And it's basically a statue of Mary, and the oldest Mary statue in the country.
That is correct. She is only 28 inches high. She's quite small, but has an incredible following and has received an incredible gift, wardrobe of clothing over the 400 years she's been here in Santa Fe, as well as jewels and crowns and other accessories.
All of which we will be able to see at this exhibition.
Well, some of which you will be able to see.
Right, because there's too much. This gal has more clothes than I do.
She has more than most people. She has almost 300 gowns and capes. They are housed in a special wardrobe room at the cathedral. And it's really an astonishing sight to see the way they are arranged and cared for by the Cofradía. The Cofradía is a confraternity that is devoted to La Conquistadora, and she is in their care and keeping, and they maintain her and her wardrobe.
Now, what is involved, and what is, I guess you would say, the psychology of icons? What do they mean? What function do they perform? Why would anybody give a statue over years 300 gowns made of silks and brocades and gold and all those kinds of things?
Well, she is looked at as a representative. Some people have asked if she is an idol, and that is not it at all. But she is a representative, and the very devout do pray to her, hoping that she will be able to intercede on their behalf with God. And the gifts have been given in thanksgiving, in most cases, where people feel that she has been beneficial to them in some way or another, are in hopes that she will intercede and assist them in their needs.
Now, this is an object of devotion for so many people in this area and out of this area. I mean, you've had visitors from all over the United States, but tell us about the opening.
Well, we had two openings. On September the 10th, we had a private opening for our members of the museum, and then on the 19th, we had a public opening. And one of the most extraordinary things for me personally, I am not Catholic, and so this has been a really very, very interesting learning experience for me. We had a number of people who came before. La Peregrina is the traveling double of La Conquistadora.
It looks the same, but it's a replica so that the first one doesn't get damaged.
Exactly, because the real La Conquistadora is obviously over 400 years old and quite fragile. And so La Peregrina is what is taken out of the cathedral. And we had, I don't know, about 45, 50 people who arrived before the Peregrina came and was installed. And when they came in, they dropped to their knees in prayer in the gallery. And it was just a very moving thing to see. Regardless of your religious belief, you have to respect the beliefs of others and their devotion to this figure.
And it does, it definitely invites the question for each of us, what is it that we feel that way about?
Yes, I think there's such a variety of belief systems in the world. And it's been very interesting for us at the museum in that we have had people from all religious persuasions who have come to the exhibit. Attendance figures have more than tripled since La Conquistadora's accessories and gowns have been installed. And so we've had a huge variety of people. Some have come out of curiosity, some out of devotion, some out of just an interest in understanding better what the devotion is about.
Yeah. And this is part, if you live here in Santa Fe, this is part of your history in one way or another. Now, has this La Conquistadora, has anyone ever tried to steal it? Her?
Well, yes. She was kidnapped back in the 1970s by a couple of young men, as I understand it, who were going to hold her for a ransom. And she was sequestered away in a cave, but she was found. And the story goes that she was safeguarded in the local jail until such time as the cathedral could be made more secure so they could be sure that it wouldn't happen again.
The sculpture was put in jail, the object.
That is correct, for safekeeping purposes
right,
only.
Right, right, it wasn't DWI.
No, not at all.
Now, you have a series of lectures about La Conquistadora.
That is correct. Our first one was last night by Marina Ochoa, the historian for the Archdiocese. But next week, on the 26th, we will have Dr. Tom Chavez, speaking about confraternities, the groups that do safeguard La Conquistadora. On November the 9th, the historian Will Roth will again be speaking on Southwestern Santos.
So this is a Tuesday night thing?
No, they do differ. On okay. Friday, November the 19th, the very Reverend Monsignor Jerome will be speaking again on his view of La Conquistadora. And then on December the 14th, another Tuesday, Jamis Chevalier will be speaking. She has recently written a book, a new book, on La Conquistadora, and she'll be talking about her book and her experiences with the Cofradía and La Conquistadora.
And if our gentle listeners haven't memorized all that, you can always go to SpanishColonial.org and find the schedule.
That's correct. Or just call our offices at in Santa Fe at 982-2226.
Now, you also have, this coming Saturday, a very unusual event happening at the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art.
We do. We're going to have a very traditional matanza. This is the pig roast, the pig in the pit, with all of the side dishes, everything that goes with it. We have the master matanza chef of New Mexico, I think, Steve Otero, and his crew are going to come up and cook the matanza for us. He will start cooking at 8 o'clock, but the food will actually be served between 11 and 2. This is going to be at the museum at 750 Camino Alejo up on Museum Hill. And we invite the public, but they would need to call for reservations.
Donna Padacci is Executive Director of the Spanish Colonial Art Society, and once again, the exhibition Threads of Devotion, The Wardrobe of La Conquistadora, is at the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art on Museum Hill here in Santa Fe through the 31st of December. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe radio cafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.